From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Although the stock market is booming, the majority of Americans continue to struggle financially today. A hand-to-mouth existence is sadly quite typical, and many families find building up a nest egg out of reach, let alone buying a home, saving up for their kids' college, or their own retirement. The struggles are even worse for people of color. But what if all it took was a few $1,000s per person to deliver economic security to American families? Exploring this idea with concrete examples and real-world solutions is Robert Friedman, whose new book proposes a so-called prosperity bill. Robert Friedman is founder and chair emeritus of Prosperity Now. He helped create the U.S. microenterprise and savings and asset building fields and the international enterprise development and child savings fields. He now joins me to discuss his new book. It's called simply A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. Welcome to the program, Bob.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
So when you say prosperity, at first glance, if one isn't paying attention to the details of your book, it sounds like a word that Republicans like to use a lot, prosperity. And it's a word that unfortunately has come to mean in practical terms, wealth for the already wealthy. When you say prosperity for everyone, it sounds like in your book really mean everyone, those among us Americans that are, you know, from working class all the way up to middle or upper middle class, right?
I really think that's the promise of America, something we've subscribed to in the ideal, unfortunately not in the reality, but I think we could make it part of our reality. I think everybody needs the ability to live in the future, not just in the past or in the present, to be able to shape a future for themselves. And I think they need a nest egg to do that. We have a thoroughgoing wealth building policy in this country. We spend on the order of what we're spending for defense on building up the wealth of families. But right now, we're rewarding the rich, missing the middle, and penalizing the poor.
So the tax reform bill that was passed into law by the Republican Party at the end of Donald Trump's first year in office promised prosperity for everybody because it would withhold fewer taxes. But even that bill seems like is in line with existing government policy and would only worsen our current inequality and even be even greater inequality for people of color, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It did nothing, I think, to really invest in the American people. It was a product of, I think, this false thinking that it's the wealthy and corporations that are creating jobs, innovation, driving the economy. Really, I think if you look in our history, the kind of policies and investments that have driven significant, widely shared, long-term increases in economic well-being have been investments in the common genius, investments in common people, all net new jobs created in the economy over the last 30 years were created by new businesses. Those are not businesses started up just by wealthy people. They're started by people all across the income spectrum. And I think you can find a lot of evidence that actually low income people are more entrepreneurial than upper income people, if only through necessity.
So let's talk about what it is that you propose in this prosperity bill. The first response from lawmakers to any proposal that involves, you know, helping ordinary people is, well, it would probably cost too much. It's going to cost too much. What does it cost? Where does the money come from? So explain what you mean by this prosperity bill.
Sure. So what you have to realize right now is we are spending in excess of $700 billion a year, that's with a B, on tax incentives for home, business, education, retirement savings, home mortgage interest deduction, preferential capital gains rates, pension fund exclusions, 529 college savings plans. But as we have designed them, they overwhelmingly reward the rich, miss the middle, penalize the poor. So the very richest 0.1% of American households, that is households making over $1 million a year, get an average annual benefit from those subsidies or incentives of $160,000, whereas working families making under $55,000 get an average annual benefit of $226. That is $1 for every $800 the wealthiest get. This is obscene. The private sector and the private economy is doing very well at generating wealth inequality, which I think is more profound and larger than income inequality even. We don't need to subsidize that with the government. So essentially, my proposal is that instead of investing in people who don't need it, let's invest in everybody. And my organization, the nonprofit Prosperity Now that I founded 40 years ago, and its many partners around our many partners around the country have proven that given even a few thousand dollars, low income, even very poor people will start businesses, buy and keep homes, go to college, create economic futures for themselves, their families, and the communities. If we simply invest in their savings and provide them incentives, equivalent to what we're just funded out of what we're already spending, we could ensure that every American has the ability to amass a few thousand dollars a year to invest in their business, in a down payment on a home, in their dreams and talents and work.
Now, of course, those who are already wealthy know the power of being able to invest a few thousand dollars over many years, often taking advantage of programs that they find out about through the financial experts that they pay a lot of money to tell them about. But those who need that kind of wealth multiplication, if you will, the most, often don't have that information and often don't have the means to even gather that small amount of capital to even start it. I'm really interested in the child savings field that you are a pioneer in. Every parent wants to leave their child better off than they were. And you point out in your book how just a few thousand dollars, and even the, you know, going from $5,000 to $10,000 makes a huge difference. When you start out in childhood, someone turning 18 has a much bigger start in life than they would have otherwise. Explain what the child savings idea is.
So the idea is that every kid should start with a nest egg of some amount of money. It's kind of hope in concrete form, if you will. Most kids do not have that today, and particularly kids of color. We found that a poor child with a college savings account in her own name is three times more likely to attend and four times more likely to finish than someone without, with even with less than $500 in the account. It's partly about finance, but it's also about expectations and psychology. If you think you're going to college, if your parents think you're going to college, you probably will. And so over the last 20 years, really, in this country and around the world, there has been a growing community practice, state policy, even federal policy, around building child savings accounts. There are now 500,000 kids in 42 states and localities in the U.S. That have these programs. They start either at birth or in kindergarten. Cities like San Francisco, Oakland, states like Maine, Indiana have these programs. In Maine, Harold Alfond, who wasn't able to afford college, did very well with an insurance business, has provided in his estate that every kid born in Maine gets $500 at birth for a college savings account. This tends to be the way forward. We could fund this for every one of the 4 million kids born each year if we simply return the estate tax to where it was in the early 2000s and make that federal subsidy for kids, really, available to all kids rather than just the kids that don't need it.
So the estate tax currently is essentially what used to be, that when a wealthy person passed away, before their inheritance made it to the people they left behind, it was taxed. And Republicans, conservatives, those who are more interested in seeing the wealthy get wealthier, pushed against that, called it a death tax, and have really cut away at the revenues that the government has access to. So today, you have wealthy Americans able to pass on much more of their inheritance when they pass away, leaving their descendants with a much greater leg up on life than their fellow Americans, right? So if we return things to the way they were, we could actually equalize the playing field a little bit.
We could not only equalize the playing field, but seed our future, right? I mean, the kids growing up today, a majority of whom will be kids of color, are our future. They're going to be taking the jobs, creating the firms, creating the jobs and innovations of the future. If they're not prepared, we will all suffer. You're right that critics on the right decry death taxes. I think who better to tax than the dead? You know, they don't complain. really, we're only taxed on estates, the very wealthiest estates. The tax bill last year raised the threshold for any tax on estates to $11 million, estates of $11 million for an individual or $22 million for a couple. Why should we be taxing earned income, labor income, which has been stagnating for 30 years, by the way, at a higher rate than we tax unearned income? And remember, the wealthy, and I would count myself among them, I was born lucky. Why should we pay less in tax, than someone who's working 2-3 jobs at minimum wage?
Right, because the descendants of a wealthy person have a much, much, much bigger advantage when they start out with money that has been inherited. So let's talk about the issue of home ownership. This is such a difficult issue for so many Americans. I'm here in California, and you are as well, where the housing market is so tilted toward those who are already wealthy. We have a shortage of housing. People are leaving the state because they can't afford to buy a home here anymore. And when the market crashes, you have hedge fund managers that swoop in, put cash down on houses, and then turn turn around and charge ever-increasing rents to those of us who continue to live here. How could the government, through a few simple mechanisms and policies, help ordinary Americans become homeowners by just investing a few thousand dollars?
Right. Well, let's just go back a little. First of all, homeownership is the centerpiece, has been the centerpiece of the American dream. 89% of Americans across incomes, across racial groups, want to own their own homes. And for good reasons. I mean, homes are more than a house, right? They're the incubation, they're refuge, they're the place, the nest, where you develop dreams and skills and families develop. We should be clear that the home ownership market is one that's designed by the government and created. It doesn't just descend on us. 120 years ago, only 10% of Americans owned their own homes because they had to come up with the full price of the home on day one. We created the 30-year mortgage. We passed the Homestead Acts, to which still 25% of the country can attribute its wealth. We can do it again and extend home ownership opportunity today because of those mechanisms, the 30-year fixed rate self-amortizing mortgage created by the federal government, and the housing finance giants like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and other guarantees grew home ownership to about 2/3 of the American people, but in a very different racial profile. So 72.5% of whites owned their own homes, but only 43% of African Americans and 46% of Latinos. We have always done this with housing discrimination and redlining. But if we take the $251 billion a year that we're providing in federal tax homeownership subsidies, the most famous of which, but not the only of which, is the home mortgage interest deduction, which really doesn't help anyone buy a house. It's a reward for owning, really a reward for owing on a house. But if we took some of that $251 billion and instead said, we'll match your savings for a down payment on a home, we could enable all Americans to develop what is the key barrier to home ownership, which is down payments. There have been extensive demonstrations. We've done some with so-called individual development accounts, match savings accounts for home, business, education. The self-help in North Carolina did a big home ownership program for people making generally under $30,000 a year. 52,000 homeowners resulted from that experiment. We can open up home ownership opportunity for Americans again, if we just put our minds to it and deploy our substantial subsidies more rationally, more fairly, more productively.
What you're saying is that we already have all of this money that's that the government is pouring into it with all of these very specifically designed policies that simply aren't doing what they could be doing or are designed to not do, and redesigning them would make an enormous difference. On a question that, you know, has perplexed so many of us, this is an election era issue often. We see potential presidential candidates understanding the importance of talking about reducing wealth inequality. But you have some, you've in effect written a guidebook, it seems. And now in your book, you also have a lot of examples, real world examples of how smaller scale programs of the kind that you discuss have actually benefited real people. Can you give us some of those examples? Because it really helps, I think, to hear a concrete story of somebody.
Sure. There's so many stories, and I do profile 24 in the book who, you know, I regard as economic heroes who, you know, have led led lives of the American ideal, you know, the rags to riches story. I think of David Greer in San Francisco, grew up here, tried to go to college. It didn't really work, went into the army, succumbed to heavy drinking habits, got out, ended up homeless for a while, literally living under the anchorage of the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge. Today, with the help of an individual development account, a match savings account, he owns not one but two homes in San Francisco, one of which produces income and the other is a home for his growing family. Mariana across the bay was an immigrant who again enrolled in an individual development account program where her savings were matched dollar for dollar, or actually I think 2-to-1. She never thought she could own her own home. She wasn't in a stable home until she was 9. She found out about the program, started doing research, found a home in Oakland, was able to buy it. Her timing was good. It was kind of post 2008. The rise in home equity enabled her to weather losing a job from an abusive employer. It allowed her later on to look around for a job for a while that was suitable. So, you know, the benefits of home ownership are myriad.
Overall, currently, Americans that are struggling financially, we have such a ripple effect through society, don't we? I mean, people stay in bad marriages for longer than they should because they don't have the economic independence. People who have tremendous amounts of college debt end up being unable to get out from under that cycle and don't have the freedom to follow their heart's passion because they're simply trying to pay off those burdensome loans and on and on. Doesn't that have a tremendous psychological impact on us as a whole?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, money is such a strange thing. It's a counter, really. You know, it's a way of counting, but it has tremendous psychological effects. I mean, if you're in debt, as most America, you know, as a third to a half or more of Americans are, you're not feeling very good about yourself. You're not looking ahead. You know, you're in stress, probably, you know, eventually a victim of post-traumatic stress syndrome, which lowers IQ and narrows bandwidth. I think that's why I think that everybody needs what I call future money, a nest egg for the future. A buffer against the everyday accidents and illnesses that otherwise become crises, but also an invitation to imagine a future better than the present, to plan for that future and prepare for that future when maybe only you believe, and ultimately the very American ability to invest in yourself and your kids. Again, we could create a system that allows that. And we have done that in the past. I think over the last 40 years, we have demonstrated child accounts, home accounts, business accounts, prosperity accounts, which are kind of all of those combined. We know the community practices that work. We know what state and federal policies work. We know the kind of market adjustments that are necessary. There are literally hundreds of thousands of people who have benefited from these programs, and there are rigorously evaluated random assignment control group experiments that have been run. We know these things work. We know how to do it. It just remains for us to do it. We can also look to our history. I would say the greatest policies in our history, those that have created significant, widely shared, enduring economic well-being, have been investments in the common genius: universal public education, the Homestead Acts, the creation of the 30-year mortgage by the federal government. Perhaps the best example is the GI Bill. We don't think about the GI Bill a lot, but we said to our returning veterans from World War II, look, you defended the country. We will provide you low interest or no interest home loans, business loans, college loans. Those GIs, financed by that GI Bill, drove our post-war growth. In 10 years, they generated 220,000 businesses, 5 million new homeowners, 9 million new college students. They democratized college. Within 10 years, they tripled, the GI Bill tripled the middle class changed the income distribution from a pyramid to a diamond. We could do it again. There was a dark side to the GI Bill, which, like those other human investments, basically was an investment in white men.
Right,
it never invested in the 17 million women who were the arsenal of democracy. It was deliberately left to state and local officials at that time operating under Jim Crow in the South to administer. As a result, African Americans in the South got very few of the GI Bill benefits to which they were entitled. I think we need a GI Bill for the 21st century, where the strengths of that bill outweigh the weaknesses. So for everybody, for home, for business, for education, for other high return human investments, citizenship, assistive technology, designed in such a way that it closes the racial wealth divide rather than exacerbates it. And I just should note for your listeners, African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, many Asian Americans have a few cents for every dollar whites have. This is a product of our history, and it is an incredible penalty starting from birth. You tell me the assets of a family and with the birth of a child, and I can pretty well predict to you there that child's educational, health, occupational, income status 50 years in the future. This is not the meritocratic society we want to be. I would also argue, based on our experience, that by investing in everybody, everybody will benefit. The educational benefits of the GI Bill alone, the return on investment was $7 to $1 just for the educational benefits. We would grow the whole economy if we allow people to move ahead. And, but there's a need for more than just wage-based income. Wages have been stagnating while expenses have been going up and volatility has been increasing. We need to reinvest in the American people. We need to bring people back into the marketplace and into the quest for a better future for all of us.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Bob. Thank you so much, and good luck with the book.
I really appreciate this opportunity.
My guest has been Robert Friedman, founder and chair emeritus of Prosperity Now. He helped to create the U.S. micro enterprise and savings and asset building fields and the international enterprise development and child savings fields. We've been discussing his new book, A Few Thousand Dollars, Sparking Prosperity for Everyone. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.